We offer short mandala.
Sangye Rupa Shu Chodan Sangye Chonam La Janchu Badu Dhani Kyapsu Chi Nage Chinyi Gipe Sonam Gi Drola Penchi Sangye Rupa Shu Chodan Sangye Chonam La Janchu Badu Dhani Kyapsu Chi Nage chinye gipe sonam gi penchiya sangye drupa shu.
So Geshla made notes yesterday, some annotation to the teaching given by Kyabjul Rinpoche. So he thought of drawing today from the notes that he has made yesterday. So I said again, Geshe-la made yesterday some notes from the teaching given by Kyabjul Rinpoche, and he plans to draw from his notes today and go in an orderly fashion over the things that we've covered yesterday. So we'll begin with chapter number 2. So for those of you who have the text, you can look at page 45. It lists on the four greatnesses of the Lamrim teachings. The first one is the greatness of enabling one to know that all the teachings are free of contradictions. The second is the greatness of enabling one to understand that all scriptures are instructions for practice. The third is the greatness of enabling one is it to find a concourse in 10. There's another one. We'll begin with the first. So the first greatness As taught in chapter number 2, the greatness of the Lamrim is of enabling one to know that all of the teachings are free of contradictions. So in general, we can classify the teachings of the Buddha as two. The teachings as scriptures and teachings as realizations. So then, with respect to the teachings as scriptures, there are a great many teachings that the Buddha gave. Some of them can be taken literally and some of them cannot be taken literally. The Buddha taught sutra and the Buddha taught mantra. This is, say, tantra. And within tantra, we have four classes of tantra. Within the Paramitayana, the perfection systems, there are four schools of thought, four tenets. So there are a great many of teachings and many classification of teachings, and one with a lesser knowledge, lesser learning, might see some contradictions in those teachings of the Buddha. So in looking at the greatness of the Lamrim teaching, it enables one to see that there are no contradictions in the teachings of the Buddha. And there are great deprecation that came about through stating that, for example, there are some things that one should not train it with, or that were not taught in the Mahayana, but they are found in the Hinayana, and vice versa. There are things that are found or trained it in the Hinayana, but not at the Mahayana. So such positions are great deprecations of the teachings that the Buddha gave. So then, in enabling one to see that there are no contradictions, we look at the great many teachings that the Buddha gave. Some of them are the main teachings, and some of them are the branches of the teachings. With respect to the main, the principal teachings, there are teachings on generating bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, and wisdom that realizes emptiness. With respect to the branches of the teachings that were included in the small scope and in the medium scope, you could take them to be branches for developing wisdom, realizes emptiness, and the mind of enlightenment. So then all the teachings of the Buddha can be taken either as the main points or the branches of the teaching. So then one can see that, therefore, there is no contradiction in the teachings in either they're classified as main points or branches. So then for those of you who have the translation of the Lamrim Chelmo, when you look at page 46, there's an explanation of the greatness of enabling one to know that all the teachings are free of contradictions. And down from the middle of the page, it says, Bodhisattvas make it the goal to accomplish the good of the world, of all living beings. Since Bodhisattvas must take care of students who are followers of all the three lineages, which means that they have to take care of Mahayanists, this is, say, Bodhisattvas, but they also have to take care of Hinayanists, hearers and solitary realizers, which means Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. They need to train in the paths of all of those lineages. And since they need to train in those paths of all those of lineages, there are no contradictions in the teachings of the Buddha. So then when we look at the bottom of the page, it also, to add to that, Dhammakirti's commentary on the Compendium of Valid Cognition, the Pramana Vartika, it says, it is difficult to explain to others the results of causes that are obscure to oneself. Therefore, if you have not ascertained something exactly, you cannot teach it to others. So then in moving on to page 47, if you look down from the top of the page, there is a quotation that is taken from the Mother of Conquerors, which is the 8,000 verses Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, which says, Bodhisattvas should produce all paths, whether it is a path of a Shravaka, a Pratyeka Buddha, which means hearers or solitary realizers, or a Buddha, and should know all paths. They should also perform the deeds of these paths and bring all of them to completion, which can also be linked up with a certain position that existed before, in that some held both in Tibet and in India that when one practices the mantra, when one practices Mahayana, one does not need to train in the Hinayana. Or if you train in the Hinayana, you ought not to train in some paths that belong to the Mahayana. But this is a mistake because, as it says here in the quotation from the Mother of the Conquerors, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, Bodhisattvas should produce all paths, whether it is a path of Shravaka. A path of a Shravaka, or here, is a path in which one meditates on the 16 aspects of the four truths, aspects such as impermanence and so forth. So a Bodhisattva should train in those paths and also generate those paths in the mindstream, those paths of a Shravaka. Not only that, Bodhisattva should also practice in the paths of a Pratyeka Buddha, a solitary realizer, in generating in the mindstream a realization of the emptiness of duality, in a sense that the emptiness of object and subject, or apprehender and apprehended as being different substances. They should general realization of the emptiness of existing as an external object. So bodhisattvas should generate that parts in the mindstream, and they should also, needless to say, generate the parts of the Mahayana. So then, looking at that quotation, it says, bodhisattvas should produce all those parts, whatever is a path of a Shravaka, a Pratyeka Buddha, or a Buddha, and should know all parts. They should also perform the deeds of these parts and bring them to completion. So when we say that they should perform the deeds of these parts, it means that on the path of seeing, they should generate a perceptual realization of this, and on the path of meditation, they should also continue with that on the path of meditation. So we do not come to learn those parts in that we observe something externally, like observing a form or a body of another person. We generate those parts in our mind stream. So this is what this section indicates. So when it says that bodhisattvas should produce all parts, whatever is the path of a Shravaka, here it means to say that out of the two things that hears those Hinayanists train it, either the practice or the views, here it refers mainly to the view. And particularly in referring to training in the view of hearers, we recognize that our afflictions, anger and attachment are based on grasping at the self, and what we aim at is abandoning or ridding ourselves of grasping at the self. And we do that in stages, in that we begin with levels that are coarse, and we make a way to eliminate levels that are subtle. So in that way, we abandon or we eliminate grasping at the self. So we begin with shravakas or hearers, and we eliminate the grasping at the self as asserted by the shravaka, which is rather a coarse level of selflessness. So the Buddha taught the view of selflessness, and he says that the self does not exist. So this is where we begin with. We begin with, first of all, recognizing that there is a notion of I that appears to our mind when we think of I or me. Right? So there is something that appears to our mind. We recognize that I want to be happy. I do not want to suffer. So there is that notion of I, and we begin with trying to recognize what the I is, what is me. So the Buddha spoke of this I or me as non-existing. This is to say selflessness. So what we then need to work out is how there's a certain appearance of I or me that appears to my mind, and yet I or me do not exist in that way. So in looking at the position from the viewpoint of the hearers, the Shravakas, they say that the I or me cannot appear to my mind without something else appearing to my mind. For example, we have are sets of aggregates, right? The five aggregates. So we have the aggregate of form and the aggregate of feeling and so forth. So I, or me, cannot appear to the mind without the aggregates such as form appearing to one's mind. It's like, for example, if you look at the table in front of me or the table in front of Geshe-la, in order to lift that table to carry it somewhere, you need to either take hold of the top of the table or the legs of the table or something like that. And you cannot lift the table and carry it without lifting that physical thing. So similarly, when we look at the I or me, this that notion is if there is I or me, a person that exists, that can appear to the mind without something else appearing to the mind, but this is not the case. So the selfness is asserted by this school of thought, refers to the self cannot appear to the mind without something else appearing to one's mind, such as the aggregates. So then when we follow the generation of such view in our mind, as stated by the sutras and also many treatises that were composed on that basis, we recognize that there is a certain notion of an independent self that appears to our mind, and it appears to be independent from the aggregates. And we seek to analyze or to investigate whether the self exists in that way or not. So when you think about an analogy that illustrates that, should you see a fearsome wild beast far away, like a tiger or a lion, it might be that a certain state of fear or terror will arise in your mind. It is a dangerous animal. So then from far away, it will seem to you to be a real animal. But should you get closer and closer to that and find out actually it was not a wild beast, it was not a lion or a tiger, it is just something that appeared to you like that, like an illusion, your fear will be dispelled in a sense that your mind will find a sense of peace. It will not be that terrified by the sight of a lion or a tiger. So similarly, you can say that we have certain afflictive states of mind that arise in our mind. We have anger and we have attachment. And when we then investigate the objects of anger and attachment and see that while they appear to our mind in a certain way, they do not exist in that way, in that, they do not exist in this way, but it's not that they do not exist, right? No, so they're neither existent nor non-existent in that they appear to be independent, but in actual fact, they're not independent. When you discover that, when you come to understand that, your mind is no longer that affected by such afflictive states of mind as anger or attachment.
Così come nel caso di aver paura di una tigre che in realtà si scopre che non c'è, o di avere tanto attaccamento per un oggetto quando scopriamo che quell'oggetto non ha quelle qualità, eccetera.
No. Mm-hmm.
Also in that quotation it says the Bodhisattva should generate a path of the Pratyeka Buddha, or a solid to realize it. So for those of you who have studied tenets before, the different schools of thought within Buddhist philosophy, you might have come across the view of the Chittamatra school of thought, the mind-only school of thought, which speaks of objects such as forms and so forth not existing externally. What they mean to say in the mind-only school is that forms and so forth come into being from the activation of an karmic imprint that was placed previously upon one mindstream. And his honest the Dalai Lama often explains that view in the following way. He says that suppose that in a dream you see a pleasant place, you know, a place that is really pleasant to behold, and your mind becomes joyous. Or it might be that something distressing is happening to you in a dream. It might be something that quite sad that appears to you in a dream. So your mind is affected by that in a dream, and yet when you wake up, you find that it was nothing but a dream. So your mind then becomes relaxed or peaceful. So similarly, we can say that according to the view of the mind-only school of thought, we might see things existing out there externally, and our mind becomes affected by that. Now, we might see something that is very pleasant or something that we find completely unpleasant, and the mind, and it seems to exist just like that externally out there. And yet, from the viewpoint of the mind-only school of thought, those things come into being from the activation of karmic imprints that were previously placed upon a mindstream. And in that sense, those external things are created by the mind. They do not exist out there independently from the mind as external objects. They come into being from the mind, from the activation of karmic imprints that were placed before on the mind. So when you understand that, then your mind is no longer affected by the sight of such external things. So for example, when this is illustrated, you can say that there is a, if you look at the mug on Geshe-la's table, there is liquid or water in it. And it takes three types of beings. So there is a god, there is a human being, and there is a hungry ghost. So dependent upon the imprints that they have placed before on the mindstream, they would see the liquid in a different way. For gods, this liquid, this water, would be nectar. Now, for them, it would not be just ordinary water. For them, it would be nectar. For human beings like us, whatever is in that mug will be water. Whereas for hungry ghosts, it will be pus and blood. So that illustrates the view of the mind-only school, the Chittamatra school within Buddhist philosophy, that whatever exists, whatever mind apprehends out there externally, does not exist like that externally. It actually comes into being from the activation of imprints that were placed previously upon our mindstream. So that refers to Bodhisattvas having to generate the path of Pratyeka Buddhas, realizing that view.
No.
when we look at contemporary science, particularly when we look at quantum physics, we can see that there is a similarity between the views that are propounded in quantum physics and the view of the mind-only school of thought. In quantum physics, there is a discussion about whatever is observed not existing apart from the observer, in that if there is no observer, there is also not going to be the phenomenon that is observed. So there is a great similarity between quantum physics and the view of the Chittamatrins. Now, there is an Indian scholar, Dhammakirti, who composed texts on logic. One of them is the Pramanavartika and the companion, the commentary to the Pramanavartika, which he referred to form and the awareness that apprehends form as arising simultaneously, in that they do not exist apart from each other. They arise, both of them, from the activation of a single imprint. So, in going back to the quotation that is taken from the Mother of Conquerors, it says in the middle of that quotation that we said that whatever is a path of a Shravaka, we explain what it is. Whatever is a path of a Pratyeka Buddha, we also explain what it is, that emptiness of not existing as an external object, and a path of a Buddha. Now, a path of a Buddha refers to the realization of the lack of inherent existence, the emptiness of inherent existence, which is the most subtle level of emptiness, the most complicated level of emptiness or selflessness, the emptiness of inherent existence. What we get at in looking at the view of emptiness of inherent existence, is that phenomena are merely imputed by conceptuality. Right, so they are merely imputed by conception or conceptuality, which is the most subtle view. So, for example, with respect to I or me, I do not exist inherently. When I, as an imputed object, is sought for, it is not found. An illustration of it is not found. So you cannot find I or me. I or me is only imputed by conceptions. So I or me is a dependent arising. When we look at dependent arising, dependent origination, we can recognize that there are different levels, different subtleties to dependent arising. The closest level is of causality or karma. Now, when you look at causality, then you look at the more deeper level, the level of karma, actions, and the results. And you can move on to a more subtle level of dependent origination. At the end, you use dependent origination in order to illustrate that phenomena are empty of independent existence. Since something arises independent upon others, it is empty. It is empty of independent existence. So when we develop our understanding of what empty means, we don't take empty to mean that phenomenon in question does not exist whatsoever. This is not the meaning of emptiness. Emptiness means not existing independently. So then, when you understand that this phenomenon in question arises independence on and in relation to others, you understand that it is empty. It is empty of independent existence. And likewise, when you understand that it is empty of independent existence, you understand that it is a dependent origination, for it arises independence upon others. So this is the view that is begotten it when Bodhisattvas developed the path of Buddhas. So then, in looking at those views, what we also need to see is that the development of these views is a path that will lead to our own freedom from afflictive states of mind, from anger, attachment, and so forth. Those are the paths that lead to freedom from our own afflictions. And that should be our approach when we study texts such as this. So we take up a text such as this and we study it, and we should always ask ourselves, how is it relevant to me? How is it helpful to me? What help or what assistance can I get from this text? Our attitude shouldn't be such that we think that I need to study it so that I can teach it to others. I need to study it so that I do not make mistakes in teaching it to others. Of course, you need not to make mistakes when you teach it to others, but your attitude to begin with should be, how is it of benefit to me? How is it helpful to my own mind? And Dharmakirti in his companion to Valid Cognition, the Pramana Vartika, in the second chapter, said exactly that. He said that you do not study in order to become a scholar so that you can have discussions with scholars and have debate with scholars and you yourself be appreciated as a scholar. First of all, your attitude should be such that you think of, how can you use that in order to subdue my own mind, in order to tame my own mind? So then looking again at the quotation from the Mother of Conquerors, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 8,000 verses, it says towards the end of this paragraph, they should also perform the deeds of these paths and bring all of them to completion. So to perform the deeds of these paths would mean to ripen those who are not ripened. To ripen those who are not ripened would mean to draw those sentient beings to the Dharma if they haven't been drawn yet. So you draw them to the Dharma by teaching them topics such as karma, actions and the results, that level of causality. Through that, you draw them to the Dharma. You ripen those who are not ripened. Now, those that are already ripened, you perform the deeds in that you make them become liberated from cyclic existence through giving them teachings. And you then bring them also to completion by causing those who have been ripened to proceed even further on, not only to the state of liberation, but also to eliminate their cognitive obscurations, so that in dependence on eliminating their cognitive obscurations, they could become Buddhas. So altogether, when we look at the meaning of performing the deeds of these paths as performed by bodhisattvas, they ripen those who are not, those who haven't been ripened yet. They liberate those who are not liberated, and they bring to omniscience those who haven't gone to omniscience yet. So then when you think about it, then you can see that an attitude such as thinking that I'm a Mahayanist, I do not need to study the Hinayana, is mistaken. It is mistaken. If you're a Mahayanist, you do need to train at the path of Hinayana for the reasons that we have just mentioned. Of course, there are some points that, as a Mahayanist, you you will not train it. Like, for example, a Hinayana attitude is seeking to attain the state of liberation for your own sake alone, right? So you're seeking the state of liberation for your own sake alone. So although as a Mahayanist, you do need to train yourself with a along the path of the Hinayana, still taking that attitude and training your mind and thinking that I want to attain the state of liberation for my own sake alone is something that you will not train it. After all, as a bodhisattva, you're training at cherishing others and seeking to benefit other sentient beings as much in whatever way you can. So apart from some individual points or separate points, such as training your mind in the attitude of attending the state of liberation for your own sake, you will leave that out, and you will still train in all the other parts of the Hinayana. So this is one doubt that is eliminated in relation to the first greatness. Now, for those of you who have the text, if you look at the bottom of page 47, there's a qualm. It says, in order to enter the perfection vehicle of the Mahayana, you do need to the paths that are explained in the Hinayana scriptural collection. So you might think that, all right, I got it. It is true, it is correct that in order to train along the Mahayana path, I also need to train myself along the Hinayana paths. I get it. This is correct. However, you will have a doubt. It says, in order to enter into the Vajrayana, Geshe said that means to say into the mantra or into tantra, the paths of the perfection vehicle are not shared in common with the paths of the Vajrayana, which means that Kwan says that I get it that I need to train in the Hinayana if I, as a Mahayanist, train in the perfection system. However, the Vajrayana is a different story. It is a separate path. For in the Paramitayana, in the perfection system, attachment is viewed as something that is to be abandoned. I need to eliminate attachment. Whereas in the Vajrayana, in Tantra, attachment is taken onto the path, or it is taken as a path. And therefore, these two are dissimilar or they are distinct. So then, in the practice of the Vajrayana of Tantra, those practices of taking attachment onto the path, right, using attachment as a path. So this is something that is found, of course, in the Indian tradition, and this tradition made its way to Tibet, so it also existed in Tibet. The original way that it was taught was in secret. So it was thought that that should actually be kept as a secret, practice in secret, taking attachment onto the path. But in the passage of time, it became quite common. So now when you visit Tibetan temples, for example, temples of Tibetan Buddhism, you see quite a lot of depictions, representations, statues of male and female deities that are sitting in union, that are sitting in an embrace. So you see those displays of taking attachment onto the path or certain aspects of Tantra out in the open. So it is different to the way that it was meant to be, in that it was meant to be kept in secret. So like 30-odd years back, there was a discussion that was held at Ladakh, where Geshe-la is coming from. There is a Rinpoche that comes from Ladakh called Bakula Rinpoche, and discussion also was held in relation to the philosophical system. Different points in the philosophical systems were clarified, and Bakula Rinpoche made a comment at that point that he feels really uncomfortable to speak about Tantra, because Tantra should be kept secret. It is not something that should be discussed in the open. His Honor the Dalai Lama was also present in that occasion, and Bakula Rinpoche, he replied to Bakula Rinpoche's comment that, well, Bakula Rinpoche is correct in that one shouldn't, in a general, discuss Tantra out in the public. Still, when we look at the need to do it at this day and age, since it has become so common to see images, representations connected with Hasyoga Tantra, both in Tibet but also in other places, then there are also a lot of misconceptions that arise in with respect to that. So there is a particular purpose, a particular need to discuss that in order to eliminate such misconceptions.
Lord, how about the
So also Geshe said that he doesn't wish to speak about it a lot, but since his Honest does mention the need to dispel those misconceptions, Geshe thought that maybe it's good to say a few more things about those misconceptions with respect to Tantra, particularly because nowadays we come across representations or statues of male and female deities that are sitting in union, that are sitting in that even embrace. So if we don't understand well what is happening in High Sacred Tantra, we might develop some misconception with respect to such practices of High Sacred Tantra. For when we get engaged in sexual activity, then we do that because what we seek is sexual pleasure, the pleasure that arises from sex, and we are attached to the pleasure that that we derive from sex, from sexual relations. So then you might wonder, well, if in Tantra, if it is not done for the sake of experiencing or for the sake of satisfying that attachment that we get from sexual pleasure, what is the purpose of that practice? So the purpose of that practice, of such practices, from the point of view of High Sacred Tantra, is to follow a certain process by which we gather in all our cause consciousnesses, and through that process we become able we can then become able to use most subtle consciousnesses in order to ascertain emptiness. So a consciousness of bliss or pleasure is a more subtle consciousness. So when you follow the stages of dissolution, and some of you have heard of the stages of dissolution of the mind that occur leading up to the moment of death, there are subtle consciousnesses that become manifest along that process. So there is a consciousness of the white appearance, the red increase appearance, the black penultimate or near attainment appearance, and finally the clear light of death. For us, it occurs to us, for most of us, due to the power of karma, right? Because of karma, those minds become manifest throughout the process of dying, and we have no control over that process. So what we seek to do in the practice of High Sacred Tantra is, through the force of our meditation, we want to make all those cause consciousnesses gathering, dissolve, in the way that is similar to the way that it happens along the process of death, so that we will be able to make use of such subtle consciousnesses to ascertain emptiness. So then the bliss that is coming from such a union, a sexual union, is used in relation to that. So what happens when one experiences that bliss or that pleasure that arises from that sexual union is a type of consciousness that is more subtle, in that you experience that when more cause consciousnesses have gathered in and dissolved. So the goal is to then use that consciousness of bliss to ascertain emptiness. And then when you have thus ascertained emptiness or realized emptiness using that consciousness, you can use it in order to eliminate cognitive obscurations. Right, cognitive obscurations. So you might rely upon a consort in order to give rise to that consciousness of bliss, that consciousness of pleasure. Now, with respect to a consort, there are actually two types of consort, as taught in scripture. there's a consort that is called a mental consort, and there is an action consort, which means that it's an actual, in scripture, it is called a knowledge lady. Now, so there is actual consort, a female consort that you might rely upon. It is said that you can get to the stage when you rely upon an action consort, a real knowledge lady, only when you reach a certain level of realization, right? So for us as ordinary being, we can say that we are not at that level yet. It's only when you reach that high level of realization that you are permitted to rely upon an action consort, which is a real knowledge lady. So really, in order to talk about it, you need to have attained a high Sugo Tantra empowerment, right? So if Geshe-la speaks about it, he assumes that you guys have attained a high Sugo Tantra empowerment. Well, we can say that it is very likely that all of you have attained the Kalachakra empowerment before, and therefore Geshe-la is making the assumption that therefore it is suitable or permissible to teach it or to speak about it in this context. When you look at it from the perspective of high Sugo Tantra, you get to the stage where you manifest a pure illusory body or the impure illusory body. Those stages of the pure and impure illusory body are taught in the context of the Guhya Samaja Tantra in high Sugo Tantra. So when you then arise into, for example, the pure illusory body in reliance upon the Guhya Samaja Tantra, it's not that you have a body such as the one that we have now, a body of flesh and blood. You have a body that is called a body that is made of light, so to speak, and therefore it is not that you enter into that union with a body such as this. It is a illusory body, pure illusory body that is used for that sake. When you look at the biography of the great master Lama Tsongkhapa, it is said that Lama Tsongkhapa attained the state of a Buddha in the Bado state. So in the Bado state, he took the Bado state as a path to the Sambhogakaya, right? This is how it is stated in High Sugo Tantra, taking the Bado as a path to the Sambhogakaya. So some scholars explain that, in that it's not that Lama Tsongkhapa did not have the ability to become Buddha before that. It is rather that in order to prevent a certain misconceptions in the mainstream of the followers of Lama Tsongkhapa, who could have claimed that, well, it is suitable for me to rely upon such practices because even Lama Tsongkhapa relied upon a knowledge lady. This is to say, relied upon a partner or a consort. Even Lama Tsongkhapa relied upon a knowledge lady, and therefore it would also be permissible for me to do it. So in order to prevent such claims from occurring, it is said that Lama Tsongkhapa actually attained the state of a Buddha in taking the Bado as a path to the Sambhogaka only when he reached the Bado state after death. So in that sense, you could say that actually he did not go to the Bado state. He use that as a path to the Sambhogakaya.
Yeah.
So then in going back to the Quam, it says in order to enter the perfection vehicle of the Mahayana, you do not need the path that you do need, sorry, the paths that are explained in the Hinayana scriptural collection. However, in order to enter the Vajrayana, the paths of the perfection vehicles are not shared in common with the paths of the Vajrayana because these paths are incompatible. So someone practicing along the perfection system of the Mahayana might not be able to conceive of how along the Vajrayana attachment is taken onto the path. So such misconception could arise in someone not being able to understand how something like that is possible. So Lama Tsongkhapa said that if you're unable to do it, you don't have to engage in those practices now. Don't engage in those practices now, but still you can make aspirations to be able to do it in the future. May I be able to do it in the future? So that's how you should think about it. And for the time being, there are things that are shared between the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, such as, for example, the development of the mind of enlightenment, the practice of the six perfections, such as generosity and so forth. Those trainings are common to both the Vajrayana and the Mahayana. That the paths of the perfection and the perfection vehicle and the Vajrayana are shared in terms of the mind of enlightenment and the six perfections is illustrated by Lama Tsongkhapa in page 48 in our text in drawing a couple of quotations from the Vajra Climax Tantra. The Vajra Climax Tantra says, even to save your life, do not give up the spirit of enlightenment. This is to say, do not give up bodhicitta. Also, the deeds of the six perfections should never be cast aside. Since the Vajra Climax Tantra is a tantra taught in the Vajrayana, it illustrates that the mind of enlightenment and the six perfections are practices that are shared with the Vajrayana and the perfection system of the Mahayana. So, not only the Paramitayana is shared with the Vajrayana, but also you could say that the Hinayana paths are also in common or shared with the Vajrayana. And this is illustrated in the passage that is found in the middle of page 48. So it says, moreover, the above Quam is most unreasonable because you must promise to uphold all aspects of the teaching when you have taken the tantric vow. This is in accordance with what is said in the Dhammadaka Tantra and the Vajra Climax Tantra on occasion of taking the pledges of Amitabha. Uphold all the excellent teachings, the three vehicles, the external and the secret. So the external here refers to the two lower classes of Tantra, which are Action Tantra and Performance Tantra, right? Chali and Kriya Tantras. The secret refers to Yoga Tantra and Highest Yoga Tantra, and the three vehicles refer to the hearers, solitude realizers, and bodhisattvas.
Thank you.
So then we bring the first greatness into completion at the bottom of page 49 in the paragraph that says, because the instructions in the Lamp on the Path of Enlightenment guide students by gathering all the key points of the sutra and mantra vehicles into the path for one person to become a Buddha, which means that all of those different aspects that are found in the Buddha's teachings, sutra and mantra, the four classes of tantra, the four tenets, the four schools of thought within Buddhist philosophy, all those key points are gathered together. They are suitable for one person, or therefore one person to become a Buddha. They have the greatness of producing the certainty that all the teachings are free of contradictions. So then the second greatness of the teachings in page 50 comes under the heading of the greatness of enabling one to understand that all the scriptures are instructions for practice. For those of you who have the text, if you go to the paragraphs right after the quotation from the Sublime Continuum, it says in the second line of the paragraph, nonetheless, since students in this later time will not discover the intent of these words by delving into them on their own, without depending on valid commentaries and the personal instructions of excellent beings, the great trailblazers compose treatises and personal instructions that comment on their intended meaning, which means that we add to that that one needs to rely upon the writing of Nagarjuna and Asanga, the two pioneers, the two trailblazers, in order to also develop the understanding that all scriptures are instructions for practice. So then in this section, it refers to these teachings becoming personal instructions. So first of all, considering the teachings that the Buddha gave, they are vast and extensive. So if you do not have the capacity to study that great depth of teachings, you have the systems that were set out by the two trailblazers, Asanga and Nagarjuna. But they're also very extensive. Right? You might not be able to study in their entirety the great system, the classics of Asanga and Nagarjuna. So for that, you have also those instructions, those personal instructions that come from the lamas, from the teachers. So when you consider what could constitute something that is those instructions or instructions for practice, those instructions should be such that they lead the student or the disciple to the great classics. No, they bring you to the great classics. If instructions are given to you and they do not carry you, they do not bring you, they do not lead you to those great classics, those are not authentic or they are not right instructions. The instructions should be such that they carry you along to the great vastness of the excellent scriptures.
Certa del significato delle parole dei Buddha e dei grandi commentari sul loro scopo, o se insegna un sentire incompatibile con questo, eccetera. Che cosa vuol dire? Se non ha niente a che vedere, se è qualcosa che non è rintracciabile con le spiegazioni dei trattati, non è valida. No.
Then looking at the last paragraph in page 50, it says, there are those who conclude that any classic text should be considered only as an explanatory teachings, therefore lacking the key points for practice. So there are those who make such distinctions that some classics or the classical texts, those great systems, are only explanatory teachings, which means that what they're implying is that they do not contain the key points for practice. In order to then get the key point for practice, you need to be looking elsewhere. So when you look at those classics, you find texts such as Dharmakirti's Brahmana Bhartika, which contains also a great discussion of tenets. So not only Buddhist tenets, but also it brings together some discussions that are happening in non-Buddhist tenets and outside of tenets and explains them. So when you think of the motive of such great classics such as Dharmakirti, indeed, they do lead the disciple to the state of liberation and the state of omniscience. Actually, they need to be leading the student to the state of liberation or to the state of enlightenment. So, and yet, there are still those who claim that those great classics are just explanatory teachings. Yeah, they do speak about enlightenment and liberation, but they do not contain instructions for practice. There are those who claim that. So then, when you look at the notion that is explained here, in the third line in that paragraph, it says, they hold that there are separate personal instructions that teach the core meanings that are the heart of practice. Then they imagine that there are two separate forms of the excellent teachings, the teaching that is explained to you and teachings that are practiced. In that sense, they claim that there are the great classics, such as, for example, the teachings on the perfection system, the Paramitayana, or the teachings on the Madhyamika, the middle way system, are just teachings that are explanatory teachings. Whereas if you need to put something into practice, you need to be looking for something else. Which means that what they're claiming is that those great classics do not teach you instructions for practice.
Mm-hmm.
left out something. So if you do develop that attitude that asserts that the classical texts are explanatory teachings, you're actually looking down on them. You're becoming dismissive of them in thinking that they do not contain instructions for practice. Now, to continue with that, when you look at page 51, there's a quotation from the great yogi Chanchub Rinchen, who said, concerning instructions, complete mastery does not mean getting ascertainment of a mere small volume that fits in the palm of one's hand. It means understanding all of the scriptural, all of the scriptures and instructions for practice. Now, it doesn't mean to say that you don't need those texts that contain pith instructions. It's like, no, we still do need certain things in our possession, in our disposal. It's just like saying that, in general, well, we shouldn't be attached to certain things. We should need to have enough to get by, right? We do need to have some possessions in order to get by. So similarly, while not becoming dismissive of the great philosophical system, the great classic, it does not mean to say that if you have a succinct presentation of something, it is not permissible. We can also use that. That is also helpful. Now, since Geshe-la was asked to also lead those review classes here, he says that he also would like to contribute some of his advice to us, the people that listen to the teachings. And he referred to that before a few minutes ago in saying that when you approach those teachings, ask yourself, how does it apply to me? How is it helpful to my mind? Like, for example, And Geshe-la said that with respect to what is found in page 51, the section that says, the precious teacher, Drun Tomba, said that it is a mistake if after studying many teachings, you feel a need to look elsewhere for how to practice the teachings, right? So you get some teachings from a teacher without asking yourself, how does it apply to my own mind? How is it beneficial to me? And then after the teaching is finished, you ask him, so could you give me a practice? What do I need to practice? You need to understand that the teachings that you get are instructions for practice. So, for example, you get teaching on selflessness, and as Geshe-la demonstrated it. You begin with the selflessness that is the cause level of selflessness. Then you move on to the selflessness that is asserted by the mind only school in that form, and the valid cognition of apprehending that form are empty of being different substantial entities. That form doesn't exist as an external object. And then you move on to the teachings on the absence of inherent existence, the emptiness of inherent existence. So then when you receive those teachings, you need to ask yourself, how does it apply to me? How does it apply to my own mind? How is it helpful to me? So rather than thinking that I am going to study that in order to teach it to others, you need to think, first of all, how does it apply to me? A teacher that Geshe said that he hasn't met, but he came out of Tibet, you know, at the early departure of Tibetan refugees that traveled to India. And he resided at Drepung. And around Losar, or after Losar, when again classes commenced, the class that was teaching reached the third year in the study of the Abhisama Alamkara, the ornament for clear realization, and they were beginning the study of bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. So he said, the way that he was approaching those teachings, he said that this is where we develop the mind of enlightenment in our practice, right? This is where we begin a practice of bodhicitta. So rather than treating those teachings as explanatory teachings, he said that this is where you begin. This is where you practice bodhicitta. So this Rinpoche that Geshe was referred to was a real yogi. Also, His Honest Dalai Lama commented on that in teachings that he gave, and he said that in some sense you could say that those Buddhists that come from the Himalayan regions, from Tibet, from Ladakh, from the Himalaya regions, are falling behind. Of course, they have interest in the Buddha Dharma, but they do neglect the studies. They ignore or they neglect to study. So although they consider themselves as Buddhists, they lack the understanding of Buddhism. Whereas when you look at how Buddhism is taught here, for example, in the community of Westerners, we take interest, we take notes, we strive for the teaching. So our attitude should be such that we don't think that, how can I study that in order to become in order to be able to teach it to others. First and foremost, we should ask, how is it applicable to me? How is it helpful to my own mind? Geshe said that the biography of this Rinpoche, Rinpoche is available, so it's not something they just made up. You can actually read that biography and see and come to discover his approach. So this Rinpoche that Geshe was speaking of, and I get the correct name later on, it's someone that I haven't had before. It was first of all a very very pure monk. He was a top scholar. He was the top of his class in his Geshe degree, and he graduated as a Harampa Geshe. And then he went on a particular retreat of a wandering yogi, right? So the particular type of retreat that is called in Tibet Chadral means that such a yogi kind of abandons, or no, they renunciate all their possession and then go off to do a retreat as a wandering yogi, kind of completely bereft of all possessions and necessities. So it is said that before he was given that title, it was called a Gopa Reting, and when he completed his time at the Tantric College, after completed his study, then went off to do this particular type of retreat when you renounce all your necessities and go off as a wandering yogi. Mm-hmm. Sorry, so that the place that he went on in a retreat as a wandering yogi was a place that is associated with Milarepa, some caves associated with Milarepa. Anyway, Geshe's teacher said that as it was high in the mountain and there was a stream of water that was coming down from there, he was going out one day to fetch water, right? So he was holding a bucket or a pot or something to collect water. And it was so he knew that there is those wandering yogis, people that are in those retreat in that area. So he was so fascinated by that, that he went out to fetch water. And he got kind of distracted by the whole fascination of it. And he forgot actually to fetch water. He came back with the bucket still empty. So he made his way at some point to India, and he resided at Delahousie, a settlement in India. And one day he was giving teaching on the Lamrim, and he was wearing glasses, right? So he had glasses that were made to fit him, and he could see only with one eye, right? So he was blind in one eye, and the other one was still working. So he had glasses that were made to him, and one of the lenses was a dark lens. He needed only one of them. So he used the glasses for one eye, right? The eye that he could see. And then after a few days, he replaced the lenses or changed the space. And people asked him, what's the deal with that? Why are you changing the lenses? Why are you wearing now the dark lens on the eye that you can use? And he said, in India now, if you wear glasses, you are regarded as very impressive, as an erudite, as a scholastic person. It's probably different to us. Someone that is wearing glasses is just wearing glasses here. But in India, if you had glasses, you were really special. One day he just took out the lens from the eye that he wasn't using. So he said, there wasn't a need for him to look impressive, so he just took it out. So we are running out of time, and Geshe is still teaching the second greatness. But if you turn to page 52, it says, thus, this two service cause and effect. For example, it is like showing a horse a race coat before you race. Once you have shown it, you then race there. It would be ridiculous to show the horse one race course and then race on another, right? So if you claim that those classics are not instructions for practice, that that's explanatory teachings, it would be like showing a horse a certain race course and then taking the horse to race somewhere else. It would be pointless.
Thank you.
In illustrating the second greatness of the Dambrim, in that it shows that all the scriptures are instructions for practice. In page 52, there is a quotation that is taken from Kamala Shila's Three Stages of Meditations. Now, when we read through that quotation, we need also to contextualize it in terms of the time. So, Shantarakshita, Kamala Shila, and Padmasambhava were regarded as those three scholars that were operative in Tibet at a time in which the Tibetan system, the Buddhist system, was not yet officially formalized and sealed in the sense that there were also other views that were impure views. There was a lot of misconceptions, such as, for example, misconceptions that were carried by the Chinese monk Hashang. So there are quite a lot of misconceptions happening at that time. So Kamala Shila, in his Stage of Meditation, in page 52, says further, what you meditate on with the wisdom arisen from meditation is just that which you know with the wisdom that has arisen from study and reflection. You do not meditate on something else. This is similar to how you show a horse a racetrack and then race it there. So we do need to proceed through a practice of study, reflection, and meditation. So we need to generate wisdom arisen from study. Then we generate wisdom that has arisen from reflection, and then we generate wisdom arisen from meditation. So we first of all do some study, and through studying we develop wisdom. Then we contemplate whatever we study to the point in which we develop inferential cognition of what we've studied, which is a type of valid cognition. And then once we have ascertained it with an inferential cognition, we take it on to our meditation so that we repeatedly make the mind becomes familiar with it. And this is what Kamala Shila says with respect to the order of progression. So rather than studying a certain text and looking somewhere else for instructions for practice, you follow that process with what you study. You study it, you reflect upon it, you generate inferential cognition, you ascertain what you have studied, and then you meditate on it repeatedly in order to generate realizations.
Gracias.
So then in towards the bottom of page 52, it says, therefore, when it becomes clear that when it comes clear to you that the profound and vast scriptural collections, along with the commentaries and instructions for practice, you will quickly understand that the classic texts of the Frantrac collections, along with the commentaries, are also instructions for practice. And you need to approach them with an analytical meditation. They need to be approached with analytical meditation, and this is what is stated in the previous paragraph. It is evident that this topic explaining the classic texts are, for the most part, only teachings that require analysis with discerning wisdom. If you cast them aside when you practice, how can you develop an understanding that sees them as supreme instruction? So we do need to apply ourselves to a lot of analytical meditations on the way to rely upon a spiritual teacher, a person's human body with freedoms and opportunities, death and impermanence, the mind of enlightenment, and so forth. All these instructions that we take up with a lot of analysis, investigation in our analytical meditation. And once we have done a lot of analytical meditation, then at the end we place our mind on it with placement meditation or stabilizing meditation, to familiarize our mind with what we have analyzed before. So, and then looking at how it applies to us, we can say that by and large, most of the meditations that we need to apply ourselves now, rather than just being placement meditation or stabilizing meditation, by and large, those meditations should be analytical meditations on the aforementioned topics, the topics that are found within the stages of the path, such as death and impermanence and so forth. Indeed, in the higher path of High Sukha Tantra, there are stages where you exclusively rely upon placement meditation, but this is when you reach those high level of High Sukha Tantra, whereas for us, by and large, the principal main form of meditation initially should be analytical meditation. So it seems that our time is up and we haven't completed this section, and Geshe-la feels a bit uncomfortable leaving it without any questions. So if you have one question, maybe we can take it up. Any questions? Yesterday it has occurred to me that when we look around the world, men and women, male and female, it seems that by and large there that when we look in general in the world, men are regarded better than women. No, women are being looked down upon. This is a mistake. Is there a way to improve that situation, to eliminate that gender bias here, gender discrimination?
Thank you.
So first of all, Geshe-la agrees with you that when you look at history, not only history, when you look at still different places around the world, the wet places and the still places where women are regarded as lesser than men. You know, it exists like that in India, and it still exists like that in other places around the world. But it seems that it's getting better. This attitude is getting lesser and lesser and weaker and weaker. When you look at that in terms of the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha created procedures, laid out procedures for ordination for fully ordained nuns, for novice nuns, Gelungma and Getsungma, without that sense of discrimination. Of course, you could say that in actual fact, when you look at that in terms of numbers, there is a difference in numbers, but in terms of the available procedures, the Buddha also gave procedures for full ordination for monks and for nuns and novice ordination for nuns. Now, moreover, when you look at that from the perspective of Tantra, of Mantra, there is no difference whatsoever between men and women in terms of being able to traverse the generation stage and the completion stage and reach the finality. So in that sense, there is no difference whatsoever if you're a man or if you're a woman. Of course, in the past, there have been differences, cultural differences in different places, but Geshe-la reckons that we're getting better and better, and those differences are getting lesser and lesser. So this is one thing that we can recognize. On top of that, Geshe-la wanted to draw from something that Izonas has said before. So all of us are working, wishing for, hoping for world peace, and we are working towards that. And in that sense, women have a great role to play in that. Even you could say that even greater than men. And from that perspective, women become more important than men. In that, when you think of the process of motherhood, where giving birth to a child and nursing a child, taking care of the immediate need of a child, in that sense, you could say that women have a great role in that. And that process, so that through a compassionate and peaceful behavior, a child can be taught how to also behave in a positive way, in a well-mannered way, in a way that is peaceful, in a way that is constructive. So in that sense, if all of us, men and women alike, are hoping for a better world, for a peaceful world, then since a woman is involved in the process of motherhood, you could say that women actually have a role that is important to play in that sense. And from that perspective, women are more important than men. In the narratives of the Venerable Tara, it was said that before becoming enlightened, she, in one of her previous lifetimes, she was born into a royal family that was very rich, was very influential, and her family was involved in making great offerings of food and necessities to communities of Buddhas and monks. She was a princess at the time, and she made that aspirational prayer and a pledge to be born repeatedly, again and again, as a woman, as a female, and to attain enlightenment as a woman. And indeed, this is what she did, attain enlightenment as a woman, and became Venerable Tara. So Rinpoche has covered a great distance yesterday, and because he covered a great distance in the text, he wasn't able to go into greater details with respect to the instructions that he gave. So for that reason, Geshe thought of spending more time today in explaining how all the excellent scriptures arise in instructions for practice.
Sangye shingdu mikte uwayi Joko namdak shinlache pashu Idam guru ranna mandalakam niyayatayami Gewadin yududang lama sangye drumyone Drowa chinkya malupa deye salag pasho Janchup semcho grimpoche makye panam gengyuchi Kyepa nyampa mepayang gone gondru pelwashu.